Today is Thursday. It's February 16th, 2023. This is part two of a Grand Canyon oral history interview with Richard Strange. Richard spells his last name S-T-R-A-N-G-E. My name is Tom Martin. Good evening, Richard. How are you today?
I'm good, thank you.
Great. Richard, may we have your permission to record this oral history over the telephone?
Yes.
Thank you. Richard, we left off the last interview. I was, right around the late 60s. That was a time when there was when a lot of young men were being drafted to go serve in Vietnam. How did that all work out for you?
Well, you have to back up to when I first graduated from high school. I already was eligible for the draft.
That was in 65?
That would have been in 1965.
Okay.
And so when I turned 18 in July, I had to go down and register with the Selective Service for the draft. And that was another reason, by the way, that I did want to go to college.
Okay.
Is that I didn't want to go to Vietnam. And I was pretty much chicken shit. I didn't have the guts to go to Canada like a lot of people did. I would have gone. And there were a significant number of the kids in my senior class that did end up dying in Vietnam.
Okay.
But anyhow, when I enrolled in Purdue, which was a half a semester late, I hadn't been called down for my pre-induction physical yet. But when I went on and went through that first semester and then dropped out of school, probably within a month or two, I lost that deferment, and I got my notice to go down to the draft board. When I went down to the draft board and they gave me a physical, I had some problems with my knees, and one of them had locked up, and so when I was there, I was kind of hobbling, but they put me through the entire physical, and then at the end, they gave me a one-year deferment to get my knees fixed.
Okay.
And at the time, I didn't even know what it was that was wrong with my knees yet. My left knee, though, I could hardly walk. And so eventually it just totally locked up and gave out, and I went and saw a surgeon, and I had torn a cartilage in it. And so they took out the piece of torn cartilage, and I went through, back then, it was quite an ordeal, 2 or 3 months of rehab.
Okay.
And so the next year when I went back to the draft board, when they called me back, when the one-year deferment was over, they take me through the whole process again. And then at the end, the doctor in there told me that, well, we're giving you a 4F. Because now that you've had surgery on your knee, we don't want you. And the idea was, he said, is that they don't want to have to take care of my knees in the veterans' hospitals the rest of my life.
Oh, interesting.
And I sit there and I smarted off to him about, you mean you made me wait a whole year knowing that I was going to have surgery, and also knowing that when I came back and had that surgery, you were going to give me a 4F deferment. You made me wait a whole year worrying about going to Vietnam when you knew I wasn't going to have to go.
Hmm.
And he told me basically to shut up or I was going to get drafted anyhow.
Wow.
And so I figured the best thing is to be quiet and, leave with my deferment. And so I got that deferment. I think it was... It was probably 1967 sometime by the time I got that deferment.
Okay. Now, this was getting close to the time of the Chicago riots. You were in Indianapolis, but still, what was going on there? What was that all like to grow through?
Well, in Indianapolis, we didn't have much in the way of riots and demonstrations other than the moratorium against the war. And I don't know whether that was before or after the stuff that happened, you know, in Chicago during the during the riots there. But I did participate. Guys, there must have been 100,000 kids in a park called Holiday Park in Indianapolis, and I participated in a program down in the inner city that was run by the Black Panthers out of Chicago, where myself and a girlfriend were trying to help teach young Black kids in the inner city to read.
Very cool. How did that work? I mean, was that, I imagine it was challenging.
The kids welcomed it. I was kind of a smart aleck and couldn't keep my mouth shut. And after doing this for a few months, it just occurred to me that, you know, we can help these kids learn to read, but while we're in there trying to teach these kids to read, their parents are all jam-packed into a living room, smoking pot and partying. And what these kids really needed was their parents helping them to read. And I basically finally told them that and ended up getting beat up and my girlfriend and I thrown out the front door and told not to come back. And so that was the end of our involvement.
Wow. Gosh, that's really sad because those kids need, you know, they're smart, intelligent.
Well, yeah, but what they did need, I mean, we were right. What they did need was they needed their parents.
Right. Yeah, something all kids need is...
You were hoping for something more substantial and good to come out of that story.
No, I hadn't a clue. This is a fascinating journey you're taking me on. And I'm like, yeah, this is difficult days. It still is today.
Yeah, and during that whole time, by the way, I'm in this apartment in a mixed neighborhood along White River in Indianapolis, south of the fairgrounds, and for the first year or so living there, I had to walk 2 miles to work every day. I mean, you hear the stories that kids talk about walking, 5 miles to school and back every day, or how their parents would claim to do that in the snow and ice and everything.
Right.
I actually did have to walk back and forth in the snow and ice for 2 miles to work for about a year.
This is to your draftsman job.
Yeah.
Okay.
And that was because Pontiac that I had that was my first car, after having that for a while, somebody decided to sabotage it and cut up finishing nails and put them in the carburetor, and that messed up the engine, and so that car ended up being junk. And so after that, I always drove junkers when I could afford to get something, and so it was a while again before I had a good car.
Okay. That time in the late 60s was also a time when youth of America started to speak out against the Vietnam War, in demonstrations. Did you get involved in that?
Well, yeah. See, in 1966, I was an original hippie. When I was at Purdue, there were only two of us with long hair.
Okay.
And, you know, that went right along with the music and everything. But, you know, the problem with having long hair and being a hippie in the Midwest was that it was a lot different than it was in California.
Hmm.
There were a lot of rednecks. You'd get beat up. when you'd, you know, be found on the street. And so you pretty much had to stay to yourselves. And during the demonstrations against the Vietnam War, there were only a couple of big ones, but the really one big one at Holiday Park, that's pretty much where a whole lot of young people came together. And the young people, even the ones who weren't hippies and into the long hair music and everything, they began to realize how many of their friends had not come home from the war and how many of their younger brothers were going to be subject to being drafted. And in 1968, I believe in 67 or 68, there were over 500,000 kids in Vietnam. And it was not something that was very popular with the young people,
right,
even though there was still a lot of support across America in general for the war in Vietnam. There were a lot of us young people who, because we were so close to the draft, so close to so many of our friends who didn't come back, we're sitting there in Indiana, and I remember the thing that we used to say the most was that Vietnam was about the size of a third of Indiana. And if you just took half of that and looked at how big that was, and you looked at how they had to get supplies into Vietnam to fight a war, there was only one major road and one railroad and one harbor that fed all of South Vietnam, and that from our perspective, all you had to do was to bomb the transportation and keep it continually bombed and blockaded and blow up Hanoi, and there wouldn't be a war in Vietnam, and kids wouldn't be dying anymore. And that made total sense to us. And it's kind of interesting, as it took 4 or 5 years before that was exactly what Richard Nixon did in order for them to turn their back and leave.
Okay.
So
but it took a while. I mean, it was like more and more people were complaining, more and more people were demonstrating for that next 6 years.
Yes.
And finally, you know, things started chilling down and mid-70s, 74, 73, sometime like that. So in 68, 67, you know, when you're getting your 4F, that was a big deal.
And there's another thing too. There is much about how the youth and people in America turned on the soldiers when they were coming back from Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't always like that. That didn't really happen until after the, people have a distorted view of all of that history. That didn't happen until after the My Lai massacre. And when soldiers, and after years and years of war and not knowing what and what they're fighting for anymore, I can see how things like this happened. But when soldiers started killing, indiscriminately killing women and children, and our armies were out of control, just as theirs were, things like that were going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And then you had 4 kids killed by National Guardsmen at Kent State,
right,
in Ohio, and that turned a lot of the young people against military. And it's kind of like that was something else that wasn't handled properly in this country, because there was never any reason that you should end up having young people turning against young people in your own country.
Right. Yeah, there's serious troubles there. Yeah.
But it's easy to look back in hindsight
Yes, of course.
You know,
I mean, that's what we do.
All that was wrong, but you just couldn't tell how everything was happening then. And I think that war would have gone on indiscriminately had it not been for probably Walter Cronkite.
Yes. With the nightly news, which you clearly were watching every night.
Yes. Well, he's the one who started bringing all these things to light and putting a face on what was actually happening there.
Was it on every Friday he had how many soldiers were killed?
Yes.
Yeah. That was impactful. Yeah. So, in 1970, your band broke up.
Yes.
How did that happen? This is the Ice Band, the Ice Band from Indy.
The manager that we had had an exclusive with us. You know, that's part of the deal that we made with them, and. We recorded this album, and he went and peddled this album to all of these recording companies. And what our understanding was, and I'm not sure whether this is all exactly true or not, but that he wanted front money for us so that he could get something from that initially, because he thought that once a recording got out, that once that contract was up with him, that we'd be gone and he'd not get anything out of it. And so basically no one wanted to give us front money. The only things that were offered to us were 5-year recording contracts with a 45 out every 3 months. And I'm not sure if it's true or not, but my understanding was that there were offers made to us from Columbia and Spector, and there were a couple others. I can't even remember these anymore. But good recording studios had offered him contracts, but because they wouldn't give him front money, that he turned them down.
Okay.
And that at the time he was doing that, we were pretty much in the dark about what all was even going on.
Oh, interesting.
And when he couldn't get anything out of this, he pretty much put us on the shelf and quit playing us. And so we went for several months without getting any bookings.
Oh, whoa.
And knowing that there was something wrong, and a couple of the guys just decided, well, this is bullshit, and they quit. And so... And around that same time, I got married, and my wife wasn't interested in me continuing to play music, even though that was how she met me.
Okay.
And one of the organ player, one of the guys that wanted to quit, was messing around with a 13-year-old girl and got her pregnant. And then a couple of the other guys had girlfriends that didn't like them playing, and so basically everything just fell apart. And a little bit later, Jimmy, the bass player, and Mike, the drummer, they started playing again with a couple other people, and they asked me to come and play, and I went and played with them a couple of times, but it just wasn't the same, and so... I didn't continue with it. My wife was not even happy about me even considering it.
Oh, wow.
And so it just all stopped, and I didn't play music again until after I came here in 1972. I played 3 or 4 years with the band here, but you know, we were just playing high schools and stuff like that, and we were a cover band. We weren't doing our own music.
Were
so
you still,
it was not a big deal like the other one was.
Were you still married when you came out here in 72, or did that
No,
break
I
up?
Came, I got divorced after a year and a half, and it just seemed to me that with the family problems that I had always grown up with, the music not going anywhere, even though it seemed like it should have, and the marriage failing. I after the marriage, I started working a second job to help get rid of the bills that my wife and I had accumulated, and I paid off her car. Incidentally, I wasn't required to pay off her car. It's just we were supposed to split everything.
Okay.
And I figured that that she could have the furniture and the newer car, and I'd work two jobs and get rid of that stuff. And when after all those debts were gone, I became very close with this girl, one of the waitresses there, and she came out to Arizona, and she called me up and told me I should take a vacation and come out here and see this place.
Where was she calling from? Where did she go to visit?
She came to Phoenix.
Oh, did she have family or friends there?
She had a sister who was a teacher at Tempe Union High School, I think it was.
Okay.
And so Karen came out and stayed with her sister, and they invited me up. And a friend of mine at the Indiana Highway Commission, he thought that it would be fun to visit here. So we did a 2-week vacation coming out here. And after I was here for 3 or 4 days, I decided I wanted to live here. So I started looking for a job. And the interesting thing is that...
Were you still working for Sorrell and Mattis?
No, I worked for Sorrell and Mattis for 5 years. I worked for them until 1970.
Okay.
And then I went to work for the Indiana Highway Commission.
Ah.
Because Sorrell and Mattis, they finally... the older guy died, Mr. Sorrell. And he was the one who did all the politicking and the labor, getting everything, all the contracts all negotiated,
right,
and everything.
Okay.
He had all the political ends.
Uh-huh.
And Mr. Mattis was the bridge genius in the company. And so when Bill Sorrell died, then they pretty much lost everything. And so I had to go looking for a job.
And what was it? What did you draw for Indiana Highway Commission?
Yes.
Okay, draftsman for them.
Yes, I was a draftsman, a bridge draftsman, doing steel bridges. And this is like a pretty remarkable story in itself. I went and interviewed with a guy named Marshall Dukes, and he would soon retire, and this man. Bill Betke would take over as the bridge engineer there. But
how do you spell Bill's last name?
Betke, I think it was Bettge.
Thank you.
And they were telling me about how they'd had their eye on me for years, and they never thought that they would be lucky enough for somebody like me to come in and apply for a job with the state.
Wow.
And I was like, I've never ever had anybody talk to me like this before. And, you know, and I just didn't understand how much they wanted me to go to work for them. And they basically were telling me that of the bridge plans they got from this firm that was working for them, that I was doing most of the drawings, and they had about 7 or 8 different people that were doing drawings.
Wow.
And they never could understand why there were so many of them that had my name on them.
Hmm.
Now, I'm not going to tell you that I was really good or some kind of drafting genius or anything, but it's just something that was really, really easy for me to do. And not to jump ahead too far, but to go along with this story, when I went to work for the Arizona Department of Transportation out here, I worked in the advanced design squad, which did all the preliminary engineering plans for the bridges before they went to final design. And part of one of my jobs was to order materials for all of the drafting that was done by us. And I kept track of all of the preliminary plans and how many drawings that I had done on this chart so that I could see where everything was going. And in that first year that I worked there, I did 142 drawings.
Wow.
And the amount of paper, the Mylar, that I had to reorder after that year that was used by all of the draftsmen at the Indiana Highway Commission, or at the Arizona Department of Transportation Bridge Division, I had to order 400 sheets of Mylar.
Wow.
Now, there were 15 of us.
Oh, my gosh. So you did a quarter of that?
That the other 14 draftsmen there did almost twice as many drawings in that year as what I did.
Huh.
Yeah. And that was a real eye-opener for me, because that's what they were trying to tell me when I got hired in the Indiana Highway Commission, that they had their eyes on me for years because all the plans they got in from that place, most of the drawings had my name on it. But there were only four or five other draftsmen there, so it wouldn't have been something that people were probably paying that much attention to.
Do you think that when you applied for ADOT, do you think that they, did you use Indiana Highway as a reference?
Yes, I did. And the thing is that before I went out here on vacation, I was thinking that, you know, I was already thinking that it would be nice to be able to have the guts to move somewhere. I just didn't think that I, you know, I've lived there for 26 years. I didn't know that I would have the courage to up and move to Arizona. And, you know, I'd only ever been out of the state of Arizona, just across the state line, except for a vacation when I was really young, where my mom and dad took us to Amarillo, Texas, and back.
Oh, wow.
So, you know, even going to Arizona would be a big deal. Why I asked somebody if he was interested in going, so I'd have somebody to go with.
Oh, wow.
But,
okay.
But anyhow, before going, Karen had told me that, you know, you probably ought to take a couple drawings with you and ask if somebody would do a letter of reference.
Oh, wow.
In case you wanted to get another job. So I asked Mr. Becky, I told him what I was doing. I asked him if he would write a letter for me. And he said, well, of course I would write a letter for you.
Cool.
And he said, I don't want you to go. He says, but the fact of the matter is, you know, you've been here for 2.5 years, and my biggest regret here is I can't pay you what you're worth.
Wow.
And I'm sitting there thinking, you know, wow, how come these people like me so much? And the letter that he wrote for me was just glowing. And when I got to the state of Arizona, I immediately went to the State Highway Commission, is what it was called here then, and I went to the personnel office where I was sent, and the state personnel office looked through the jobs available, and they said, well, the only job that's available for drafting is in Globe, so do you want that job? And I had driven through Globe when I was out here driving around the state, and Globe wasn't a place I wanted to live. And so anyhow, when I had come out here, I had sent a letter to the personnel division, and they had sent it to Marshall Dukes, who was the structures engineer here, and he had sent a letter back to Indiana that told me to be sure to come and see them at the state when I got here, because he was interested. And so that, when I went in, the secretary there sent me to personnel instead of having me talk to Marshall Duke.
Oh, whoops.
And so I never did get to see him, but by the time I went there, I had already decided I wanted a job here. So I looked in the paper, and I went to a couple of places. They sent me to other places. And after going to 7 or 8 places, everybody that I went and talked to, when I showed them my drawings and showed them my letter, they all said, well, you know, you've got quite a bit much more experience than what we're looking for, and none of them did bridges, and so they sent me, you know, always to someone else, and I ended up going to this place called Johansson and Durand, who was the largest engineering firm in the state, and they had, I don't know how long you've been here, Tom, or if you knew all the history back in 1973 of the Papago Freeway and the boats on it, that this firm was doing the original plans for the Papago Freeway through downtown Phoenix.
Now, I'm not sure about Johansson, but Durand, isn't Durand one of Arizona's early engineers?
John Durand was the territorial engineer back before statehood.
Okay.
Okay, and so John Durand was the founder of Johansson and Durand.
Okay.
And it was John Durand's son who was at the helm of this place when I went to work there. And they had this contract to do the bridges on the Papago Freeway through downtown Phoenix, which at the time included these god-awful heliocoils that were 100 feet up in the air, which is primarily, well, one of the main reasons that people voted against the Papago Freeway here in Phoenix. And anyhow, I was hired by them to do work on the Papago Freeway, but while I was there, I ended up doing plans for sewers at the Phoenix Zoo and, you know, a few other kind of things, subdivision plats, and I worked there for about a month, and the interesting thing about this is, like, when I left the state of Indiana, I was making $429 a month, I think it was, and these people offered me $525 a month, and I was in hog heaven getting that much money. And so then what happened was, after I had worked there for about a month, I got a letter that was forwarded to me that had gone to Indiana and came to my new address here from Marshall Dukes at the bridge division or structure section at the Arizona Highway Department. And the letter was an inquiry as to whether I was still interested in coming to Arizona, because he had a position that was coming available, and he really wanted to talk to me about the job.
Huh.
And I'm sitting there, and so I called him immediately, well, the next morning anyhow, and I told him that I went there, and I went over to the personnel, and they had told me that there wasn't anything available instead of Globe, and he started screaming into the phone, "Them goddamn sons of bitches, what the hell are they thinking?"
Oh, no.
"I never get a chance to get people with bridge experience here. They almost lost me an opportunity for somebody who is the perfect person to help us do what we need to do here."
Wow.
You know, on and on and on. And he said, "Please, please come in and see us." And he said, "I want you to talk to, Ron Breckler, who is our bridge engineer, and Ron will show you around and offer you a job." And it didn't resonate with me that he said, "Offer me a job." So anyhow, I called up then Ron Breckler, and he says, "Well, can you come in this afternoon and talk to me?" And I says, "Well, I'm at work." And he says, "Yeah, Martin told me you're working at Johansson and Durand." And I says, "Yeah, I don't know whether they'll like me coming to do an interview about a job there when I've been working here for just short of a month."
Right.
And he says, "Don't you worry about that. I'll take care of that.
Oh my gosh.
You go in and tell John Durand that you're going to be leaving to come see me for an appointment at 3:30.
Oh my gosh.
And
oh my gosh.
Sitting there thinking, gosh, well, what happens now? Are these people going to fire me? So I went in and told them that I needed to leave to go see Ron Breckler at ADOT at 3:30. And he lifted his head up and he says, yeah, I know, I'm aware.
Wow.
And he didn't look real happy.
Mm-hmm.
So I went on down and I talked to Ron Breckler, and I don't know if you're really wanting to hear all this or not.
I'm good.
Okay. Ron Breckler, he goes through this thing and he tells me all about this job and what they do and everything. And
Now you were drawing bridges, you were drawing highways, and you had the experience. You'd been working now, what, 7 years professionally
as a
draftsman.
Detailing bridges. And,
okay.
And one of the things is that a bridge detailer at the state of Indiana, when I left the consulting firm and went to the state, the detailers there actually did some design, too, because each of the squad had one engineer leading it, and he had a junior engineer, and some of them, too, working for them. But there were certain design functions that they had the senior draftsmen do, like doing some of the geometric layout, doing things like, for instance, they would give you the effective span length, which is a quarter of the way out on a beam flange to the next beam. They would give you that effective span length and left it for you to design the reinforcing steel that went into the slabs.
And like the bolts, you know, and the drill patterns? Were you doing all that?
Yeah, they teach you how to do that.
Okay.
And
cool.
So there were a lot of design functions that they would help you with, and they would encourage you to think about going back to school and becoming an engineer as opposed to the consultant who wanted to repress you, which I still don't understand. But anyhow, when I got out to the state of Arizona, the drafting techs there were basically tracers. The engineers were doing things. So now I'm in a position where there are people there that already knew there were some things that I was doing, and they would teach me and let me do some design there, not because they needed me to, but just because I could, and a lot of them liked having me working.
Cool.
But anyhow, let me back up to the interview.
Yeah, hang on a second. I'm going to back up even farther. Karen, the waitress, did she stay in Arizona as well? Did you stay connected with her, or did she head back to Indy?
I stayed connected with her for a while, but we weren't seeing each other.
Uh-huh.
We were just really good friends. And
okay.
Eventually, she did end up going back to Arizona.
Oh, she went back to Arizona?
Or, I mean, back to Indiana.
Oh, to Indy. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So so that ties up there. So you're going to visit Ron.
Yeah, and Ron Breckler, he's sitting there, and I showed him a couple of drawings I did, and he's impressed with these drawings, and he says, but as nice as these drawings are, I'm more than impressed with the letter. He said, as soon as I called and checked on your references, because he said, frankly, you just look too good to be true to us. Mr. Becky told me if I didn't hire you, I'd be a damn fool.
Wow.
And I just laughed. I'm not knowing how much of this to take seriously, because to tell you the truth, I had been pretty much repressed all my life, and this is kind of like a coming out party coming to Arizona.
Wow.
I didn't know too much about the ways of the world. And anyhow, he tells me, he says, you know, I don't really have to go through a whole lot more about this. He said, this job, now keep in mind, I told you that I was now making 520 $25 a month. He told me this job starts out at $650 a month.
Holy smolies.
And after 6 months, when you get past the initial probation period, then you automatically get a 5% raise, which would kick me up to $729 a month. And he says, and we are anticipating that the legislature in this next upcoming session is going to provide us with a cost of living increase, which they did, I think 8%.
Wow.
And so basically what happened is when he's telling me that, and then he also tells me, now I get a week's sick leave and a week's vacation at the consultant where I'm working, and he's telling me, we start you out at one day of sick leave and one day of vacation per month, and they accumulate. And after you've been here for 5 years, the vacation time picks up to from 12 days to 15 days a year, and then after 10 years, that kicks up to 21 days a year. And I'm sitting there, I'm thinking, you got to be kidding me. That means a month vacation a year?
Yeah.
And this stuff accumulates. Anyhow, oh, plus they had 14 paid holidays.
Oh, wow. Here,
including Valentine's Day, which we eventually lost because Valentine's Day was Arizona Statehood Day, which was a state holiday.
All right.
And anyhow, I'm sitting there and I'm hearing all of this stuff, and he's just being really wonderful to me. And he says, well, so do you have any questions? And I says, yeah. What do I have to do to beg you to give me this job? And he says, oh, you don't understand. It's what do I have to do to beg you to take this job?
Oh, wow.
And my heart just went through the floor. I just couldn't believe what just happened here. And he says the only thing is I want you to start absolutely as soon as possible. And this is like on a Wednesday or a Thursday that I'm in here.
I mean, by this time, did you know why Durand had just sort of, you know, looked pretty uncomfortable and said, I know?
Yeah, I pretty much figured that they knew how hard it was to have gotten someone like me there because, you know, they were the largest company in the state.
Right.
They had a full staff. And when I was here on vacation, they gave me a date that I had to be back by because they were going to fire somebody to make room for me.
But he also must have known that, and I wonder if Breckler actually called him and said, look, I want this guy, and you're going to give him to us if you want to keep getting these jobs from us.
Well,
I mean, I don't know.
I'm of the opinion that once I got there, they decided not to use me on the bridges so that Ron Breckler wouldn't know I was there.
Oh, my gosh. Huh.
That's what I think.
Huh. Okay.
But anyhow, this was like, I think, a Wednesday or a Thursday. I know it was towards the end of the week. And Ron Breckler said, all I need to know is when can you start? And I says, well, gosh, I'm a little uncomfortable about this. I've only been working there for about a month. I said, I probably owe it to him to at least give him a 2-week notice. And he says, no, I'll take care of this. He says, why don't you go back and just tell him that I'd like for you to start on Monday. He says, we really need you. And we need you more than they do, especially since they aren't using you on our contracts. And he says, they have contracts with us, is what he told me. He said, and, you know, we are their just client. And it's not like that they're going to do anything to us because that we hire you away from them.
Okay.
And so I walk out of that place like I'm going to heaven, and it was still really hard for me to go in there and to tell them that I was leaving. And there was one guy in there named Bob somebody or another who was the guy that had actually hired me, and he was just madder than hell. And he basically told me, get your stuff and get the hell out of here now.
Oh, wow.
And so, you know, I did. And it's interesting that that I didn't get to talk to John Durand, but he had called Ron Breckler when I did go to work there the next week and had Ron apologize to me on his behalf for the way that this guy had talked to me.
Oh, so, that's nice.
Yeah. So, well, I don't think he had a choice. I think they were worried. John Durand was probably worried I was going to say something to Ron Breckler about this guy getting short. I actually, you know, I thought about it, but then I thought, well, you know, there's no need to stir any of this up because this is just working out too well.
Good thinking.
So,
yeah.
Anyhow, and and the place that I ended up there in that advanced design squad, I worked there for about a month before the guy that was in there was quitting, and they moved me into there. And the whole reason was because that I could do the perspectives, and I did some cartoons on the wall in my squad room. But that first month, part of the really interesting thing about this that kind of has a, I don't know how what you would say, a fortuitous type of connection to the photography and everything else I would end up doing later, but I worked for the great-great-great-grandson of Ebenezer Bryce, Norman Bryce, who was, he was basically a Jack Mormon, but it was his ancestors that Ebenezer had sent down to settle the Thatcher, Bryce, and Safford area in this part of the state.
Okay.
And, you know, and I ended up working for Norman, and man, what, and he would tell me stories about Ebenezer and Bryce Canyon and their family in the southeastern part of the state. And Norman just thought that I was just wonderful, except for one thing. He had a 20-year-old daughter that would come in to visit, and she always wanted to come out and hang out around me. And he'd always tell me, now, Richard, I love you like a son, but you stay away from my daughter. When she comes in here, you encourage her to go away.
Tell me Ebenezer Bryce stories. What do you remember him telling you?
Well, apparently, Ebenezer Bryce had started a church somewhere over around where St. George is.
So this would be a Mormon church.
A Mormon church.
Yeah.
I think that it's still there.
Okay.
Yeah. Ebenezer Bryce was sent down into that part of Utah.
Okay.
By Brigham Young.
Okay.
To settle that area in around St. George, I believe was where he was sent. And then from there, he went over to Bryce and settled in that area. And it's interesting, Norman told me something that I remember to this day that I hear all the time. He says, you'll hear all these people tell you that Bryce Canyon is not a canyon, that it's just a bunch of cliffs along there. And he said, that's not true. Bryce Canyon is a canyon on the southern end of that part where my great-great-great-grandfather used to run his cattle, and that canyon was where he used to push them back into.
Huh.
And the national park is not named after that plateau and the Paria River down there below it is right. named after his canyon where he used to keep his cattle.
Oh, my gosh. How cool is
that's,
that?
That's the most infamous of the stories he told me, which I thought was very cool.
Huh.
And he also told me, you know, a lot of places to go and explore when I was up in Utah. Hmm. And it's kind of interesting. Back in the early 80s, because of Norman Bryce, I explored all those areas around Moab, the river and arches and canyonlands, and then up into Capitol Reef before those ever got popular.
Wow.
I mean, those were really primitive national parks. And I never would have seen the kinds of things I saw as a much younger man, because you go up there now, you can hardly get in them. I mean, you have to have reservation times now to go to arches.
Yeah, it's very different. Well, the population, of course, has gone through the roof, and, you know.
So. Yes. And, you know, Norman also, you know, told me all the history about the Mormon Trail that comes down. Actually, it came down through the Paria River. He was the one that told me about the Paria River hike, which was a 5-day backpack
cool.
that I took, because he told me about it. But he said there was a place down there in the lake where they ran the Mormon Trail, what they called the Honeymoon Trail, where they ran the wagons down there.
Yep.
And it's like just fascinating stuff that he would tell me about. And he was talking about at Lee's Ferry when the Mormons would come down across Lee's Ferry, and they were coming down where the Echo Cliff regions. He said you can see up there that there are way back up in some of these little depressions, you'll see a bunch of these big cypress trees growing. He said the Mormons planted those so that the pioneers would know where they could find dependable water.
Oh, wow.
I mean, there's like all kinds of stuff like that I couldn't even begin to tell you about. Oh, another thing, Norman was concerned when we were designing the bridges along Interstate 40 that there were a lot of times that there were contentious issues in the state of Arizona about how much pull the Mormon Church had with our religion or with our politics, how much the religion was influencing the politics and political appointments. And so when we were doing Interstate 40 and we were going to put bridges across what was the Mormon Trail, he didn't want them to put signs up there that would locate that as the Mormon Trail, because it wasn't really used for anything, transportation or drainage any longer, and he felt that people would kill it and that would no longer be preserved as a historical corridor.
Huh.
And so the guy that was doing the design of those bridges was named, was it Revalli was his last name, and I can't remember his first name.
R-E-V-A-L-L-E?
R-A-V-A-L-L-I, I think.
Okay.
And so it was interesting, what they decided to do was on the signs that labeled that crossing, they took his name, spelled it backwards, and they named that Illivar Wash.
Huh.
And so that would be an inside joke that many of these Mormons then had, that Illivar Wash is the original Mormon Trail down through Arizona, and that's where it crossed I-40.
Interesting.
How's that for your historical society getting some inside information?
That's pretty cool. Huh. And this was trying to get the Mormons that were in Arizona back across the Colorado River at Lee's Ferry along the Echo Cliffs over to St. George to get sealed in the temple for their weddings, for their marriages. And so that would be the route to get them
that
back.
That was the route of all of these Mormons that were coming out of Utah down through Arizona, was along the Echo Cliffs, and then
right crossing
down through
Lee's,
down through to where that crossing is on I-40, and I have no idea where it goes after that, but I don't know whether it came down into the Mesa Lehigh area or whether it went on over to that area in Safford and Bryce.
Or both.
Most likely there was probably a split.
Right. Sure. You bet. I mean, anybody, because it took a while to get a temple in Arizona, and I do not know that history. So.
The thing is, there. I didn't realize how many people that there were. In the early days that I worked at ADOT, until Owen Ford became the state engineer, I didn't realize how many Mormons were at ADOT that I was working for or with, because, religion was never anything that people there talked about. It's like it was really a non-issue
mm-hmm.
for those of us that worked there.
Uh-huh.
But when they started thinking that it might become a political issue, they thought, we're best to just avoid this.
Hmm. Okay.
Which I thought was really virtuous.
Yeah. Yeah. Interesting. Okay, so it sounded like right away you were given more and more responsibility at ADOT to, here's the general broad brush, go ahead and draw the pictures for what this is going to look like. And that would be beam junctions, it would be foundation drawings, roadway, roadbed drawings. I'm just thinking of standard.
Basically, when I was working on standard drawings for Norman most of the time that I was in there. I didn't really do any final design drawing, but when they took me into the pre-design or the advanced design squad, we were the ones that came up with the bridge concepts.
Okay.
What type of bridge was going to be put at a certain place. We would determine the type of bridge, the spans of it, what kind of hydrology there was in the area. We would do foundation drilling so that we could determine what kind of foundations that the bridge would have and how many spans. And then I would do a preliminary plan, profile, and cross sections of these bridges, and the drawings of the boring logs to support them. And so there was only a couple of times that I was asked to do the final design drawings on bridges, and both of them were things that were political hot potatoes. One of them was the pedestrian overpass to the high school in Globe, and because it was a political hot potato and they needed it done yesterday, and they knew that I could turn it out quickly. And another one was when they had to put new decks on the bridges over Davidson Canyon on I-10 east of Tucson. And so I was working.
Oh, that's gorgeous country. That's that gorgeous. Oh my gosh! Between Benson and Wilcox,
No, it's actually between Tucson and Benson, and where you go in, you cross the Inigo Creek, where there's the wet crossing,
Pantano,
has all that wetlands.
Pantano
and
area.
Pantano
area. It's kind of east Tucson, but it's not over the pass down into Benson yet.
I think all this stuff is between the road that goes down to Sonoyta.
Yep.
And Benson.
Okay. Yes.
It's in that area there.
Yes.
And Davidson Canyon is a bridge that when you cross it, it's got big, huge piers. Probably they must be 100 feet tall. And I think there, when we were doing to put this new deck on there, I think we also, I don't, I'm thinking that we had to put sleeves around or something on the piers too. And I'm thinking there may have been some kind of failure there that made that an emergency, but it's so long ago, I just can't remember.
Oh, okay.
I'll look those up and get a better location for you if you want.
Yeah, no, I'm kind of vaguely conversant with where you are. Something reminds me that on that drive in there, there was a bridge that was, when you thought about it, it was way up in the air. And it wasn't too terribly long, but it was up there.
That's probably the one. It goes over a pretty significant canyon, but if you're not paying attention to it, you'll go past that canyon and not know it's there.
And don't even notice it. On the yes. Yeah?
Yeah.
Okay. Got it. That's not Pantano. That's further on.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Cool. Well, that was fun. So, at this point, this is 72, 73, 74. You're starting to explore the Arizona area then.
Well, not so much yet, but sometimes, yeah. I'm going around when I can. But I wasn't a photographer yet.
Okay.
And so I didn't have the need to go on so many of these trips. But in about 1976, I think it was, I had a girlfriend who wanted to go down the Colorado River.
Okay.
And I had been up to the Grand Canyon a few times.
Just going to the south rim to look over the edge, or did you actually do a little walking around, a little hiking there?
Just over to the south rim to look around.
Okay.
And it was just a place that is like really awesome. And the way I would do this is going to see the south rim was something where I would drive up, and I had this routine where I'd go and I'd stop at Montezuma's Castle. Then I'd drive through Oak Creek Canyon.
Oh.
And then I'd go on up to Flagstaff, and I'd go over to Sunset Crater and Wapatki, and I'd drive that loop road around in there. And then I'd drive in the Grand Canyon from the east end, and I'd stop at every viewpoint. And then I'd come back and drive back to Flagstaff and back home down the interstate. And I'd usually do that as a one-day or a two-day trip.
Okay. Where would you spend the night?
That's a lot to do in a day.
Yeah, if you did a two-day trip, where would you spend the night?
If I was doing a two-day trip, I would spend a night. Well, there were three places that I used to like to spend the night. One would be at Red Rock Crossing. Back in those days, you could camp right there on the river.
Oh, wow, cool.
And
this is in Sedona.
Red Rock Crossing was still an active ford that you could drive across.
Wow,
and,
okay.
And it wasn't restricted what you could do down there at the time.
Huh.
And there was, you know, a dirt road that went back down in there, and that dirt road was within spitting distance of the creek. That parking area and everything they've got right now is located way away from where that ford is.
Huh, okay.
And I like to stay there, or I like to stay in the campground when I could afford it, in the campground at Sunset Crater. If I didn't think I could afford it, then I would drive up the Forest Service Road that you turn left on right after you get off 89. That road goes up on top of that cinder cone that's a little bit bigger than what Sunset Crater is, just to the northwest of it, that has a fire tower up there.
Oh, Eldon.
And I would just go and park along that road somewhere and camp
not
there.
Eldon.
Because that wasn't a road that anybody went up and down.
Right, okay.
Or I would go in and drive back into Lockett's Meadow.
Okay.
Up in the San Francisco Peaks.
Yeah.
And stay there, because people didn't know about that yet.
Okay.
Or I would go up and, you know, there's a dirt road that goes down to the south from there in the vicinity of Grandview that connects up with the dirt road that goes down over to Tussion.
Right.
And I would park, I would camp on that dirt road up by Grandview, or if I got all the way through the Grand Canyon and it was dark and I didn't want to go on home in the dark, then I'd oftentimes go out and camp along that road out east of Tussion. That dirt road is what I think they've got their landfill or something out there.
Yep.
But now there are so many people out using that road now, you can't find places to pull off of it anymore.
Yeah, that whole area from Grandview on over toward Tussion is packed with people now, and they're all trying to do management for it. Yeah.
Yeah, back when I used to go in there, nobody knew about it.
All right.
But anyhow, then as I got there were times that I didn't have vehicles that in later years to drive up there. I want to get back to going down the river, but in later years, there were times I didn't have a vehicle where I could go. Or there was one year I went to the Grand Canyon 17 times, and about half of them I hitchhiked.
Wow.
Yeah. Hitchhiked with a backpack. Now, the...
No, hang on. Now, wait a minute. I want to back up here a little bit. You've got a good paying job with ADOT. You're making good money.
Yeah.
And, you know how to fix beater cars, and you also know that in Arizona, beater cars are hard to find because there's no salt on the roads and cars don't rust. They last forever. So, So what are you thinking when you're like, I'm going to hitchhike up there?
Okay, $800 a month was like a big deal compared to what I was making in Arizona or in Indiana.
Right.
But still, I was having to pay, like $400 or $500 a month for an apartment because I didn't want to live with people anymore. I wanted my own place, and I wanted to live. I kind of got spoiled in the kind of place I wanted to live. I didn't want to live in mixed and rundown and crime-riddled neighborhoods anymore. So I promised myself I was always going to live in a nice place, even if I had to drive a crummy car.
Did you think about buying your own place?
No, not back then. I didn't have any money. Look,
okay.
I never bought a house until 1982. And the only way I was able to buy a house, even in 1982, with what was a pretty good buying job, was there was a man in there who took pity on me and loaned me $3,000.
Oh wow!
To for a down payment.
This was somebody working at ADOT.
He was a guy that worked for me, who was half blind that nobody else wanted, and he was there when I got hit by a. Well, I had some back surgery that put me down that didn't work well, and I got kind of on I-10 the left side of my truck was torn off by a semi that was out of control when traffic was stopped. And I basically was bedfast, only able to set up for 5 or 10 minutes at a time for almost a year.
When was this? And, when did all that happen?
This would have been around 1980-ish. And, between 80 and 82 sometime.
So let's hang on a second.
Hold on just a minute.
Okay.
Because I need to back up to the river trip.
Yes.
But let me tell you the importance of this was this man, nobody wanted him, and he got kicked out of a job that he had when this one part of ADOT got disbanded. And when I was laying on my back on a reference table, I designed the Power Road interchange while it was under construction, while laying on my back on a reference table, and I was doing stuff on the computer, writing commands that this man would go in and punch the cards for me and run them through the computer across the street, and I was able to draw up pieces of this interchange on a flatbed scanner using the computer before we ever had CAD systems.
Wow.
I was doing that using the MIT COGO program, COGO being coordinate geometrics.
Huh.
And this man is the one who enabled me to do this because nobody else wanted him. And I found things for him to draw and things for him to do, helping me with the computer stuff so that he could keep his job.
What was his name?
His name was Sam. I'll have to jog my memory to remember his last name.
Okay.
But Sam was a military vet, and he was an alcoholic, and it was important to him to keep his job because the way he explained it to me, if he wasn't able to keep a job, he would spend all his time at home drinking, and he'd be dead within a couple of years.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And so Sam looked at me as helping him, and when it came time for me wanting to buy a house, and I got turned down because I didn't have a down payment, Sam came in. It breaks me up to remember this. He came in one morning with $3,000 in $100 bills.
Wow.
And gave it to me and told me, go get your house.
Oh, my gosh. That was, like, huge.
And basically told me, I don't care when or if you ever pay me back. And I did pay him back. But I don't know. So I bought my first house down in Ahwatukee. It was in 1982, I think. And then I bought the one that I'm in now about 19 or 20 years later, and I've been in it ever since.
Okay. So
back to the river trip.
Hang on. Yeah, so Richard, hang on a second, because I'm like, all right, I know why you were hitchhiking, because money was tight, given what you were doing, and Sam helped you with a down payment to get a house, and that was 82. This river trip is in 1976, is that right?
I think it was 1976.
Okay.
It could have been 74, but I'm thinking it was 76.
So we've been yik-yakking about an hour and a quarter. And what I'd like to do, because I'm probably going to ask you way too many questions about that river trip that you want to think about, this might be a good place to put a comma in this oral history, and we'll start again.
It might be, except the one thing you need to know about the river trip before we stop it.
Yeah.
I rented a Nikonos underwater camera so I could take pictures. I could take the camera down the Colorado River with me and get some pictures. It was the first good camera I ever had in my whole life, and it was a rental.
Okay. So I'm going to ask you all about that.
Yeah.
Cool. All right.
And, you know, the more I think about this, I went on that trip with my first girlfriend here, who I was with her for, I think, only a couple of years, and I met her, I think, at the third apartment that I was in, which was in 1973, and so I'm thinking it might have been 74 that her and I went down that first river trip.
Okay.
And I did two trips down the river. There would have been that one and one 2 years later. And also something to ask me about was who I did that trip with, because I went down that. At the time, there was like Hatch and Sanderson, and I went with Sanderson mostly because of looking at that old waterproof river trip book that you used to get. It was June Sanderson's husband who did the powerboat trip up the river, and so I figured I want to go with the history, and so I went with June Sanderson's company, and it was her two sons that were running the boats on that trip.
Okay, so that would have been Rod and June, and the sons were Jerry and Larry?
I don't know. I can't remember their names.
Okay, I tell you what.
There was also a guy there that spent the most time with me who was named Tom, who I don't think was one of the sons.
Okay. Let's with that as a lead in for next time.
Yeah, I was thinking you needed something good. That river trip is a good place to start because...
That sounds great.
Tom, have you ever been down that trip on the Colorado River?
You know, I have, and what let's do, let's wrap up this... Let's wrap up this interview, and then
okay.
and then we'll do a little debrief when we're done.
Okay.
All right. So this will go ahead and conclude part two of a Grand Canyon oral history interview with Richard Strange. Today is February 16th, 2023. It's Thursday. My name is Tom Martin, and Richard, thank you so very much.
You're welcome.